You're listening to two masters on the sax, James Clay and David Fathead Newman, with something called Some Kind of Mean. Brenton Kelly on piano, Sam Jones on bass, Art Taylor on drums. That was recorded, by the way, in 1960. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, September the 25th. And a rather theatrical last-ditch effort by Senator Ted Cruz of Texas to defund Obamacare ended the way it began, without wide support from his fellow Republicans. His 21-hour, 19-minute catch-all speech, resembling in spirit that of Kentucky Senator Rand Paul's 13-hour filibuster back in March against drones, did little to convince fellow senators of either party to oppose funding the health care law, which goes into effect on January the 1st next year. The Democrat-controlled Senate is getting ready to vote on a stopgap bill to continue funding the federal government budget through the rest of the year. House Republicans had succeeded in attaching to the bill a resolution to delay funding for Obamacare until the convoluted program is thoroughly debated in Congress. But for the Senate Democrats having the 60 votes to get the bill passed, both sides of the aisle were certain that Cruz's effort to block it was purely symbolic. I want to talk today about what happened yesterday at the General Assembly, when the 68th session of the General Assembly was convened, and as is customary, heads of state and representatives of nations gather to set the tone for the session year, but also to identify major issues that they hope the body will take a look at. And of course, the President of the United States took center stage. It was, of course, at the United Nations, which is physically located in the United States in New York City. So it stands to reason that there would be intense coverage of the head of state. But as I hinted yesterday, in fact, I didn't hint it, I said it, the head of state was something of an embarrassment, I think, because the United States has just not learned how to get along, how to behave. It is not singular in this respect, but it is a pity when a country that says it's a superpower, by its language and by its actions, just betrays its conditioning as a thug. And no matter how you look at it, it's very unseemly, because even in this regard, the way one speaks, you exhibit leadership or lack thereof. I want to play a very small piece of President Obama's speech. It ran for almost 45 minutes. We won't be able to listen to all 45 today. But you will get from the very beginning where he was going, and more importantly, you will get an appreciation of, shall I say, what the truth ought to have been. Not what he said, but what the truth ought to have been. Interestingly, there were two countervailing views, and we will hear those views as presented by President Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe and President Dilma Rousseff of Brazil. We will get a countervailing view. But listen, as the president speaks so mightily of the United States and what it expects and what it wants and you would listen to the tone, and you would listen also in the content, because from the word go, there are some really huge distortions. Here's President Obama's speech, a small clip of it.
Mr. President, Mr. Secretary General, fellow delegates, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to begin today by telling you about an American named Chris Stevens. Now, Chris was born in a town called Grass Valley, California, the son of a lawyer and a musician. As a young man, Chris joined the Peace Corps and taught English in Morocco. And he came to love and respect the people of North Africa and the Middle East. He would carry that commitment throughout his life. As a diplomat, he worked from Egypt to Syria, from Saudi Arabia to Libya. He was known for walking the streets of the cities where he worked, tasting the local food, meeting as many people as he could, speaking Arabic, listening with a broad smile. Chris went to Benghazi in the early days of the Libyan Revolution, arriving on a cargo ship. As America's representative, he helped the Libyan people as they coped with violent conflict, cared for the wounded, and crafted a vision for the future in which the rights of all Libyans would be respected. And after the revolution, he supported the birth of a new democracy as Libyans held elections and built new institutions and began to move forward after decades of dictatorship. Chris Stevens loved his work. He took pride in the country he served, and he saw dignity in the people that he met. And 2 weeks ago, he traveled to Benghazi to review plans to establish a new cultural center and modernize a hospital. That's when America's compound came under attack. Along with three of his colleagues, Chris was killed in the city that he helped to save. He was 52 years old. I tell you this story because Chris Stevens embodied the best of America. Like his fellow Foreign Service officers, he built bridges across oceans and cultures and was deeply invested in the international cooperation that the United Nations represents. He acted with humility, but he also stood up for a set of principles, a belief that individuals should be free to determine their own destiny and live with liberty, dignity, justice, and opportunity. The attacks on the civilians in Benghazi were attacks on America. We are grateful for the assistance we received from the Libyan government and from the Libyan people. There should be no doubt that we will be relentless in tracking down the killers and bringing them to justice. And I also appreciate that in recent days, the leaders of other countries in the region, including Egypt, Tunisia, and Yemen, have taken steps to secure our diplomatic facilities and called for calm. And so have religious authorities around the globe. But understand, the attacks of the last 2 weeks are not simply an assault on America. They're also an assault on the very ideals upon which the United Nations was founded. The notion that people can resolve their differences peacefully, that diplomacy can take the place of war, that in an interdependent world, all of us have a stake in working towards greater opportunity and security for our citizens. If we are serious about upholding these ideals, it will not be enough to put more guards in front of an embassy or to put out statements of regret and wait for the outrage to pass. If we are serious about these ideals, we must speak honestly about the deeper causes of the crisis, because we face a choice between the forces that would drive us apart and the hopes that we hold in common. Today, we must reaffirm that our future will be determined by people like Chris Stevens and not by his killers. Today, we must declare that this violence and intolerance has no place among our United Nations. It's been less than 2 years since a vendor in Tunisia set himself on fire to protest the oppressive corruption in his country and sparked what became known as the Arab Spring. And since then, the world has been captivated by the transformation that's taken place. And the United States has supported the forces of change. We were inspired by the Tunisian protests that toppled a dictator because we recognized our own beliefs in the aspiration of men and women who took to the streets. We insisted on change in Egypt because our support for democracy ultimately put us on the side of the people. We supported a transition of leadership in Yemen because the interests of the people were no longer being served by a corrupt status quo. We intervened in Libya alongside a broad coalition and with the mandate of the United Nations Security Council because we had the ability to stop the slaughter of innocents and because we believed that the aspirations of the people were more powerful than a tyrant. And as we meet here, we again declare that the regime of Bashar al-Assad must come to an end so that the suffering of the Syrian people can stop and a new dawn can begin. We have taken these positions because we believe that freedom and self-determination are not unique to one culture. These are not simply American values or Western values. They are universal values. And even as there will be huge challenges to come with a transition to democracy, I am convinced that ultimately government of the people, by the people, and for the people is more likely to bring about the stability, prosperity, and individual opportunity that serve as a basis for peace in our world.
Well, there you go. The very picture of a democracy-loving president wishing the best for all the world, and putting at the disposal of those struggling for freedom the best wishes of America. And it's interesting that he pointed out that Ambassador Stevens arrived in Libya on a cargo ship. That's quite significant, as you will find out, because there were questions about cargo ships arriving in Libya, chock full of arms that went to a place called Benghazi, two buildings of mysterious purpose, and which Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton to this day swears she knows absolutely nothing about arms being taken to those buildings, which served as a transshipment point for arms going into Syria, into Turkey, and then into Syria. She knows nothing about that. She swore under oath before the Senate committee investigating Benghazi, she swore she knew no such thing. So we have a picture from President Obama that the United States is basically the moral point of reference for the world. It is not engaged in any of these horrible things. It intervened, quote unquote, in some instances. It intervened in Libya, for example, and it intervened in Yemen. And the assumption he's giving to heads of state, you know, this is what is so incredible. And this is why the United States is, you know, sometimes people wonder, are you serious? He's talking to heads of state. They have intelligence departments. They talk to each other. And so they regard this as a kind of perverse entertainment. Here's somebody telling us the exact opposite of everything we know. Well, we just heard the president frame for us the United States' vision and its version of Libya. Here's President Robert Mugabe giving an entirely different interpretation of the same. Are we okay? All right, we should be hearing that clip very shortly.
Office. Mr. President, if you might allow me, may I preface my speech with reference to the most glowing and most moving speech address we listened to from the President of the United States yesterday, the import of which was to get us to condemn the death, the tragic death of the United States ambassador to Libya. And I'm sure we were all moved. We all agree that it was a tragic death indeed, and we condemn it. But, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, a year ago, we saw a barbaric and brutal death of the head of state of Libya, a representative of his country, a member of the African Union. That death occurred in the context in which NATO was operating supposedly in order to protect civilians. As we in spirit join the United States in condemning that death, shall the United States also join us in condemning that barbaric death of the head of state of Libya, Gaddafi? It was a loss, a great loss to Africa. A tragic loss to Africa occurring in circumstances in which NATO had sought the authority of the United Nations Security Council under Chapter 7 to operate in Libya in protection of civilians who were said to be at the mercy of the government of Libya, led by Colonel Gaddafi. The mission was strictly to protect civilians, but it turned out that there was a hunt, a brutal hunt of Gaddafi and his family. And Gaddafi and his family we sought NATO caught up with them. They suffered the brutal deaths that we know about, Gaddafi and some of his children. And as the United States spoke, I'm sure they were aware also that they were a NATO power, that they, alongside other NATO powers, had had the authority under Chapter 7 to operate in protection in Libya in protection of civilians. But did it turn out to be that? In a very dishonest manner, we saw Chapter 7, the authority given up under Chapter 7, being used now as a weapon to rout a whole family, to commit the murders that occurred in the country. Bombs were thrown about in a callous manner, and quite a good many civilians died. Was that the protection that they had sought under Chapter 7 of the Charter? So, the death of Gaddafi must be seen as in the same tragic manner as the death of Chris Stevens. We condemn both of them. Let me begin by reaffirming the rightful and important role of the United Nations in the management of issues affecting international peace and security. In the quest for a more just and equitable international order, Zimbabwe remains strongly opposed to unilateralism and is committed to multilateralism. We therefore would like to see a United Nations that continues to be a guarantor of world peace and security and a bulwark in the fight for justice and equality among nations. It behoves us all, therefore, to take the necessary steps to ensure that the United Nations is not marginalized on international issues. Equally important, the United Nations must in future never allow itself to be abused as it was in the case I've referred to, where NATO sought under Chapter 7 authority to protect civilians, and nay, it did not turn to be that. Nations must in future never allow itself to be abused. The United Nations Security Council must never in future allow itself to be abused by any member state or group of states that seeks to achieve parochial partisan goals. The Charter of the United Nations clearly stipulates that it is as an international body that should work for the good of all the peoples of the world, big and small. Mr. President, we recognize that there are existing and emerging threats and challenges that continue to frustrate our individual and collective efforts to attain greater economic development and social progress, as well as peace and security. But the increasing trend by the NATO states, inspired by the arrogant belief that they are the most powerful among us, which has demonstrated itself through their recent resort to unilateralism and military hegemony in Libya, is the very antithesis of the basic principles of the United Nations. In that case of Libya, the African Union and its peacemaking role was defied, ignored and humiliated. The African Union was for dialogue between the Libyan authority and the so-called revolutionaries. May we urge the international community to collectively nip this dangerous and unwelcome aggressive development before it festers. In this regard, Mr. President, the theme you have chosen this session, for this session, namely, and I quote, bringing about adjustment or settlement of international disputes or situations by peaceful means, unquote, is very appropriate. And this is what we in the African Union stress, settlement of disputes in a peaceful way, through dialogue. The warmongers of our world have done us enough harm. Wherever they have imposed themselves, chaos in place of peace has been the result. The situation created by the Bush-Blair illegal campaign in Iraq, illegal campaign undertaken because it was alleged that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, when it was well known to these two and their governments that he did not have such weapons. And indeed, after invading Iraq, doing lots of havoc and getting rid of Saddam Hussein, they admitted that he had no weapons of mass destruction. And so why had they, in the first place, attacked Iraq? Why did they seek to get rid of Saddam Hussein? Was it merely because he was a dictator, as they alleged? No. He was head of a country which sat on tons and tons of oil. It was oil they required. And we saw companies rushing. Indeed, one company was headed by the brother of Bush, rushing to suck oil from Iraq. And this is what happened also in regard to Libya. The situation created, they created in Iraq, has now brought about greater instability than there ever was. You have the Sunnis rising against Shiites and vice versa, let alone the disastrous economic consequences of that unlawful invasion. The economy is unstable, society unstable, people fighting each other. Libya has been made equally unstable following NATO's deceitful intervention under the sham cover of Chapter 7 of the Charter of the United Nations and the phony principle of the responsibility to protect. I listened to the speech made by the Secretary General. He made reference to this principle. It's a principle that can be abused and has been abused. And in any way, it is still being debated. Mr. President, Zimbabwe firmly believes in the peaceful settlement of disputes between and among states in a manner that is consistent with the principles and purposes of the United Nations. In the maintenance of international peace and security, much more needs to be done to prevent conflicts from erupting in the first place, and to prevent relapses once a situation has been stabilized. Beyond deploying adequate resources to manage conflicts, it is important to address their underlying causes and to pursue more proactively a comprehensive approach focusing on conflict prevention, peace building, peace sustenance, and development.
Prime Minister Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, presenting an entirely different interpretation from the one presented by the head of state of the United States and the moral high ground upon which he and presumably the country stands. I give you this as a contrast in how the world, despite the fact that the United States maintains a particular image of itself, the world sees the United States in a very different way. Very different. Here is Dilma Rousseff, President Dilma Rousseff of Brazil, who has a particular view about the United States and weapons of mass destruction. She speaks here about cyberspace, the United States using cyberspace as a weapon of war. You will hear the English translation. She is, of course, speaking in her native language, and therefore it's translated into English by the interpreter. So a small piece, but a very, very significant piece in which Brazil stands up to the United States and gives an entirely different reference point about how it sees the great empire.
I wish to bring to the attention of attending delegations an issue which I view as being utterly important and serious. Recently disclosed information on the activities carried out by a global network of electronic spying has brought about anger and repudiation in vast sectors of public opinion worldwide. In Brazil, the situation was even more serious, since we, Brazil, feature as a target of such an intrusion. Citizens' personal data and information have been indiscriminately targeted and intercepted. Business information, oftentimes of high economic and even strategic value, have been the target of spying activity. Also, communications by Brazilian diplomatic representation offices, including the permanent mission of Brazil with the United Nations and even the very presidency of Republic of Brazil, were subject to interception of communications. Meddling in such a manner in the life and affairs of other countries is a breach of international law, and as such, it is an affrontment to the principles that should otherwise govern relations among countries, especially among friendly nations. A country's sovereignty can never affirm itself to the detriment of another country's sovereignty. The right to security of a country's citizens can never be ensured by violating the fundamental human and civil rights of another country's citizens. Even worse, when private sector companies uphold this type of spying activity. The argument that illegal interception of information and data is allegedly intended to protect nations against terrorism is untenable. Mr. President, Brazil knows how to protect itself. Brazil, Mr. President, repudiates Brazil, tackles and does not provide shelter to terrorist groups. We are a democratic country, surrounded by democratic, peaceful countries that respect international law. We have been living in peace with our neighbors for more than 140 years. Like so many other Latin Americans, I myself fought on a first-hand basis against arbitrary behavior and censorship, and I could therefore not possibly fail to uncompromisingly defend individuals' right to privacy and my country's sovereignty. without the right to privacy. There is no real freedom of speech or freedom of opinion, and therefore there is no actual democracy. Without respect to sovereignty, there is no base for proper relations among nations. What we have before us, Mr. President, is a serious case of violation of human rights and civil liberties, a case of invasion and capture of confidential secret information pertaining to business activities, and above all, a case of disrespect to national sovereignty, the national sovereignty of my country. We have let the U.S. government know about our protest by demanding explanations, apologies, and guarantees that such acts or procedures will never be repeated again. Friendly governments and societies that seek to consolidate a truly strategic partnership, such as is our case, cannot possibly allow recurring and illegal actions to go on as if they were normal, ordinary practice. Such actions are totally unacceptable. Mr. President, Brazil will further double its efforts to equip itself with legislation, technologies, and the mechanisms that will protect us properly against illegal interception of communications and data. My administration will do everything within its reach and powers to defend the human rights of all Brazilians and to protect or in the human rights of all citizens in the world while protecting the fruits of the ingenious efforts of Brazilian workers and corporations.
That's President Dilma Rousseff of Brazil. Notice what the President said. Brazil has had cordial relationships with its neighbors for more than 140 years. And the United States supposedly is a friendly country. So why does it violate and disrespect the sovereignty of its friend and, by the way, huge economic market, Brazil? Which is why she will not be coming to dinner. President Rousseff has notified the United States that a kind of summit meeting with President Barack Obama, slated for October the 23rd, will not happen until there is some acknowledgement and profound apologies to correct the invasion, as she says. It's a kind of cyberspace used as a weapon of war against her country. And in the meantime, she has gone beyond that. She has put in place a measure. It should be enacted, they're planning for it to be enacted soon, to remove the cyber control of services to Brazil, to have the servers in Brazil, which of course is a huge, a bad piece of news to the monopolists of this particular resource. It represents, or it will represent, a $32 billion dent in the technology business. So we see here that the United States has a particular image of itself, and it actually believes that other people believe it. And this president has the nerve to get up there in public and say these things, knowing full well that not only do these heads of state have an entirely different point of reference, but the people of the world have an entirely different point of reference as well. Bringing that theme back home to what is happening now with Obamacare, where the rush is on to get this through, you know, there lies there. There's something wrong. And we can't just say, well, the Republicans are being, you know, pretty stupid in trying to get this piece of legislation that has been passed, it's now a law, to have it repealed via defunding. But in the middle of all these arguments that they're making and, you know, the theatricality of it and, you know, the predictable Republican-Democrat fight that we have heard, there is some legitimacy to the claim about Obamacare and about that law. The law should not have passed. And for good reason. And the president, again, used that duplicity and got this 2,700-page law. It probably has grown since then. 2,700 pages passed, literally in the dead of night, carefully disguised as something else. This law, which now is going to be followed by every American, or else you will incur a penalty. This is what is called the individual mandate. Whether you want to have health insurance or not, whether you can afford it or not, you will be compelled to have it or pay a price. You have to pay the IRS if you don't have insurance come the first of the year. But here we have a law that never came up for debate in committee. This law was never argued and you know, you would imagine 2,700 pages should be significant enough to, you know, get the whole country engaged in this. Most people in the United States have no clue what this is about. The legislators themselves have no clue. I don't think there's a single legislator who can actually confess that they have read every single letter, every single page of a 2,700-page law. This law did not go through the regular constitutional process. This law, when it was a bill, was written in secret. It did not come up for committee hearings. It did not come before the houses, both houses of government. It never made it there. This law is actually, when people think that this is about a health care policy, and that it became law as health care policy. It didn't. It became law by IRS stamp of approval. The IRS agrees that this is a tax. And since it is really a tax, the IRS could sanction it without it being discussed in Congress in the way that laws of this type should be discussed as policy. This is such a huge fraud. This is huge. This law was the carefully crafted law that was given initially to the co-president of the United States, Hillary Clinton, who was given cabinet-level status by her husband to come up with something that they could cook up as a, quote, policy, healthcare policy, that effectively rewarded all the folks that they knew who would, of course, express their loyalties and their appreciation in many, many ways. So this was done in secret. The law literally was crafted by the insurance industry and the healthcare industry. Has nothing to do with the actual service, healthcare services to people. And this mandate, as it is called, which means that everybody must have it, literally is a business thing. You have to buy insurance from government approved healthcare or insurance agencies. You see how, you see, this is the hugest piece of pork barrel legislation you've ever seen. But what is very important and what has to be understood, and this is why the Republicans have a point. Although we are clear that both parties have proven to be completely useless to the American people. But insofar as they're arguing, there is a point to this. Even though they're not arguing that particular point, because they are equally liable as Republicans, they should have insisted, once this became clear, that this bill was being shuttled through the IRS and not through Congress. They even got the U.S. Supreme Court to admit this. The U.S. Supreme Court signed off, and they keep telling the American people, look, why are they upset? This law was passed in the House. This law passed Congress. This law even passed the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court even approved of this. The Supreme Court approved of it as a tax. The Supreme Court approved of it as a commercial activity. Let me read you Chief Justice John Roberts' majority decision on this piece of legislation. I'm quoting here. The Constitution grants Congress the power to, quote, regulate commerce, unquote. The power to regulate commerce presupposes the existence of commercial activity to be regulated. If the power to regulate something included the power to create it, many of the provisions in the Constitution would be superfluous. Our precedent also reflects this understanding. As expansive as our cases construing the scope of the commerce power have been, they all have one thing in common. They uniformly describe the power as reaching activity. It is nearly impossible to avoid the word when quoting them. The individual mandate, however, does not regulate existing commercial activity. It instead compels individuals to become active in commerce by purchasing a product, on the ground that their failure to do so affects interstate commerce. Construing the Commerce Clause to permit Congress to regulate individuals precisely because they are doing nothing would open a new and potentially vast domain to congressional authority. And then it goes on. Under the mandate, if an individual does not maintain health insurance, the only consequence is that he must make an additional payment to the IRS when he pays his taxes. That, according to the government, means the mandate can be regarded as establishing a condition, not owning health insurance, that triggers a tax, the required payment to the IRS. Under that theory, the mandate is not a legal command to buy insurance. Rather, it makes going without insurance just another thing the government taxes, like buying gasoline or earning income. And if the mandate is in effect just a tax hike on certain taxpayers who do not have health insurance, it may be within Congress's constitutional power to tax. The question is not whether that is the most natural interpretation of the mandate, but only whether it is a fairly possible one. As we have explained, every reasonable construction must be resorted to in order to save a statute from unconstitutionality. The government asks us to interpret the mandate as imposing a tax, if it would otherwise violate the Constitution. Granting the act the full measure of deference owed to federal statutes, it can be so read. The Supreme Court is validating the government's position that this is not about health care. This is about the government's right to impose a tax. The IRS agreed that this law is in fact a tax. Obama is selling it as health care policy. In fact, he insults the nation once again when he convened with his good buddy and pal Bill Clinton at the Clinton Global Initiative just yesterday, in which he's telling folks, you know, hey, wouldn't you like to have insurance that costs you less than your monthly phone bill? That's what this is going to do. It's a hard sell, but we know. If you never, ever get to know the entrails of this bill, as most everyone in the country, I said 2,700 pages, anything those lying Clintons think is great should come under automatic suspicion. So we come full circle to see how consistent President Obama is. He lies, gives false information at the international level. He lies to the people at home. And therefore joins that pit of vipers that Congress, the executive, the legislative, and even the judicial branches of government have become. People can't trust this government. And that is why, in a weird way, one hopes that somehow this Obamacare debacle, the Clintons' legacy to their own assured futures as well-paid retirees, this should be looked at more closely. You see, we have a smart guy, you know. He's a smart guy. He went to Harvard, you know. And everybody practically in his administration, he just raided the Harvard pool of graduates and said, oh, you're from Harvard? You're hired. And their mission is greed, period. This is not the way it's supposed to go. Not a piece of legislation this monumental and complex. Why should a bill be 2,700 pages in the first place? You know, lawyers wrote that. And they wrote it that way because they have thought of every possible way that they can continue to be rewarded, that they'll get the goodies, they'll fix the so-called health policy so as to benefit their buddies on the outside in the insurance industry, in the healthcare industry. But you must read the majority opinion of the court to understand that even when they went to court, and of course they said, well, look, the Supreme Court passed it, the Supreme Court agreed with us, the Supreme Court, this is legitimizing this piece, this is economic terrorism, this president has shown open and repeated contempt for constitutional law. The Congress is useless because this last-ditch effort that they're fighting for now is purely as a way of trying to win some kind of, a couple of good ducats for the Republican Party. Still has nothing to do with a real sensible and affordable alternative to what is. A bunch of vipers. So, again, I hope we tied that nicely together. Lying to the world in the same way they're lying to us right back here at home. And this is why people should vote with their feet. These people don't deserve to get any support for this kind of behavior. They are perverting justice. They're perverting the law. They're doing whatever the heck they want to do. And because most of them, the majority of people in Congress now, are millionaires, that's they're doing everything to the benefit of the club. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. We'll continue the discussion tomorrow. I just wanted you to appreciate the fact that the United States, always wondering, why do they hate us? Well, you just heard why. Just two views. And there were many more like that. And that is why the United States is losing respect in the world community of nations, as it is that Congress and the presidency and the Supreme Court are losing respect right here at home. I want to thank you for joining me today and allowing me to bring this information to you and to cause you to think about it. This magic that was done to transform policy into a tax and get the U.S. Supreme Court and the IRS, essentially, in passing policy. It's a great, neat trick, but really, it isn't because it's so transparent. Thanks. Keep listening. Let me hear from you. You can always reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D stories, at gmail.com, on Facebook, at Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. And certainly you want to stay tuned. Why? Because we have more good programming coming up. Right after me, it's Jack Rasmus with Alternative Visions. Stay tuned. Keep it right here.